Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Today we have John Manza, who is the Assistant Secretary General for Operations at NATO. Prior to that position, he served at NATO on the international staff. He served over 20 years as a Marine in the Department of State, in the Department of Defense, and so he has a wealth of knowledge, and we're so thankful that you've taken the time to be with us today. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And as a personal goal of mine was to get John over here and to talk to all of us about what's happening at NATO. John and I have worked together for many years, and I've watched him climb steadily all the way up the ladder to being actually the most senior American right now on the international staff at NATO, and also doing a job that I have seen him do in other capacities, which is military operations. And I think there is no one better to be in that job than John. And so it's so great to have you here, John, to talk about all the things you're doing.
Well, thanks, Jim. Though Rose is senior to me on the international staff. Rose Gottmuller, who's one of my heroes.
She's one of mine too. So I will tip my hat to Rose. but no, you're number one in my heart.
I think where we wanted to start is really with the basics. And so can you explain to listeners who don't know the ins and outs of NATO what it is you do in your position?
Sure. So I have a pretty broad portfolio, which has just recently been expanded. But the guts of the portfolio are NATO's current operations, so Afghanistan and Kosovo and Iraq and maritime operations. I also handle our plans. So we have plans for contingencies throughout the alliance that we're continuously updating with the allies. And I have exercises, both the exercises we do in the headquarters, like scenario-based discussions and crisis management exercises, but we also look at NATO's broader exercise portfolio to include the military exercises. And most recently, though, we've reorganized the headquarters, and I am now going to have the great bulk of capacity building for partners inside my division. So elements that were formerly in other divisions like defense education, building integrity, the PARP program, where we work with partners to help them organize their military forces, that now all falls under the operations division as well.
And I know readiness has been one of your primary focuses or a key focus. And so in other kind of ground laying work, if we go back to the 2018 Brussels summit, readiness was obviously a key focal point of that summit. Can you explain why it is that readiness played such a central role in that summit and why allies and partners chose to prioritize that issue over some others?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth looking at the history, though, of readiness over the last several years. If you go back to the Wales summit, where Jim was there, that summit was right after Crimea, and this was the big wake-up call for the alliance. So, you know, stepping back even farther in time, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union started really a decline in readiness for conventional combat in NATO. And we fell to a point where we really weren't ready for some of the larger scale operations that allies might have to undertake against a pure rival like Russia. So Crimea was the wake-up call, and at the Wales summit, we took some necessary but insufficient steps. We formed up the Enhanced NATO Response Force and the Vanguard element, the Very High Readiness Joint Task Force. So that was a good step, but frankly, poor behavior by our Russian friends have further enhanced the drive for readiness. So at the Warsaw summit, we put these battle groups into the three Baltic states and Poland, which was another substantial step. And then most recently at the summit in July, we introduced the Readiness Initiative, which is commonly known as the 430s. Mm-hmm. And to me, this, we're now talking steps that are sufficient I would say, in our current construct. So the work that lies ahead of us is how do we integrate all these different elements of the last several years into a coherent package that provides the allies with the options they want in a time of crisis. And to me, this is especially important. It's not because, you know, we're warmongers thinking about the Russians. It's that these conventional forces really give us diplomatic options in a time of crisis, because moving conventional forces around helps reassure allies who feel threatened, and it sends, obviously, a deterrent message to potential aggressors.
And I just wanted to pick up on one thing you said, the 430s Readiness Initiative. Can you also just explain a little bit about that, about what that is, and implementation? Are there kind of key barriers that you perceive to implementing that initiative?
Sure. So the 430s, you need kind of a bumper sticker for things politically, and this is a good bumper sticker, and it's part of, especially what Secretary Mattis calls former Secretary Mattis calls the culture of readiness. So the 430s is 30 mechanized infantry battalions, 30 naval combatants, and 30 kinetic squadrons, all ready to go within 30 days. And we say ready to go in 30 days, it means ready to be employed on the battlefield in 30 days. So the level of readiness is much higher even than the level of readiness we'd have in the Very High Readiness Joint Task Force. This means that you have to do the time and space math to be out of whatever nation you're in and able to be employed within 30 days. So it's a substantial increase in readiness. And 30 battalions, 30 squadrons, 30 naval combatants, that's a fairly substantial force that'll have us ready, I think, to take on any challenge that we might foresee in the near future.
That's a hugely helpful laydown. Thank you.
Well, it really is, and it's a tremendous amount of work that happened, and frankly, it was overshadowed, I think, by a lot of the more public back and forth about the 2% and that type of thing in July when that happened. But actually, I think the summit in July at NATO headquarters was one of the best that we've had. Even though I wasn't there at the table, I will tell you, I think it was a tremendous success, and you all should get a lot of credit for that. But let me ask you, what's the report card now? It's really early, and nations are going to have to put money towards readiness. They're going to have to procure. They're going to have to train. There's a steep road ahead. But so far, how are nations now coming to grips with this readiness requirement? Is there a lot of grumbling and promises that in a few years will they be there, or have they grabbed on to this and they are running ahead with it?
Well, we're in the initial stages right now of putting this together. So, you know, we had the political commitment, which was very firm, as Jim said, at the summit. But it's taken a few months now, and we're working closely with military colleagues at our Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe at SHAPE to figure out exactly how these forces would be made available by individual nations and how they might be employed. But it's really too early right now. I think we'll hear a little more next week at the Defense Ministerial about where this is going, but too early to say right now. But, you know, one of the things I think is very important for all allies is that, you know, we hold their feet to the fire, that we ensure that we get what was promised. And this is not an easy lift. So this is important work, as Jim said, for the alliance.
Well, let me take you back to something that's finished up a few months ago that we've talked about both in The Dish, which is also published by CNAS, as well as our podcast here, and that's Trident Juncture. You mentioned that you do exercises, and certainly you were part of that along with Jamie Fogo, another great colleague. And so that was a hugely important exercise for a lot of different reasons. And if you could just, without warning, what was your personal takeaway from Trident Juncture? Where did you feel that it came off better than you thought? Did you feel that there were some significant problems that were identified that you think we need to work on? Or were you Did it seem like it just went off without a hitch and now we're going to move on to something else? And so there's not a whole lot of looking back at Trident Juncture today.
Well, I think allies are very proud of Trident Juncture, and they should be. I mean, this, you know, we talked back from Wales to Warsaw to this most recent summit. I mean, this is building upon readiness initiatives that have been going on for quite some time. You know, and it was not in a small exercise. It was, you know, 50,000 troops and hundreds of armored vehicles and aircraft and naval combatants, and we demonstrated a wide range of capabilities under the sea, on the sea, in the air, at land, amphibious operations, expeditionary operations, really a substantial exercise, and not an easy exercise, you know, in the North Atlantic, not in the middle of the summer, but in the late fall, and rough sea conditions. Really demonstrating, I think, all of NATO's capabilities in one difficult place, because Norway is more difficult, you know, especially that time of year than Italy. So it was. I'm quite proud of not just the planning, the execution, the political commitment, but the troops themselves. The, you know, the individual skill of aviators and soldiers and Marines and the whole lot coming together to make that happen.
Did you smoke out some problems, or were you surprised that actually things came together pretty well?
No, of course. But to be totally honest, there were not that many problems to be revealed in that exercise. And so I think we should feel quite good about that. And, you know, the desired effect is similar to what I said before. We're showing allies what we're capable of doing, which reassures them, and we're showing potential rivals what we're capable of doing. So it reached certainly its strategic objectives, but all the way down to the tactical objectives. Yeah. It was a great exercise.
Good.
I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about an issue that I think is increasingly occupying the minds of more and more people, and that is the issue of democratic decline, including in some of the NATO member states. And I think there's a real debate that's being had. On the one hand, there's those who see democratic decline in NATO member states as one of the most fundamental challenges to the alliance. And then on the other hand, you have those who say, well, no, it's a military alliance, and as long as we can all agree to defend each other, these issues are not problematic. And it's something that we've seen before in Portugal and Greece historically, and it was something that NATO was able to get through. So I wonder, from your purview, overseeing operations and training and those types of issues, how you look at that debate.
Well, I think, you know, it's good to start by looking at the Washington Treaty itself, which makes it clear that it's not just a military alliance, it's a political military alliance. It's an alliance that's built to defend democratic values. So, you know, in the alliance, sure, you know, over our history, we've had nations that have perhaps slid a little bit away from democracy, but what better forum to bring them back in than to have them at the table with all the other democracies in one room, consulting with each other. You know, and I think in operations, certainly it provides a venue for us to take a bit of a functional approach. I mean, these allies are all working together, not just, you know, in the NATO headquarters sitting around the big table, but they're in the field together, developing relationships, sharing ideas, going to each other's schools, which is extremely important. So all that cross-fertilization, you know, from lieutenants up to ministers of defense is a great way to keep allies in check and following democratic rules.
Let's shift gears again, and instead let's head to the sands of Iraq. And I want to say the sands of Iraq because NATO has now taken on this, it's not a new mission, it's kind of resumed the mission that it had when it was called NATO Training Mission Iraq back in the early 2000s, and it transferred out of that mission, and now after the summit in Brussels is taking back on this idea of going to Iraq and helping to train the Iraqi security forces so they can better deal with things like ISIS. What's interesting to me is that unlike those early days when we were putting together training missions both for Afghanistan and ISAF, as well as Iraq, as well as other places too from the United States. You know, we've been in this training mode before. What are you doing, because this is in your portfolio, what has been your experiences both with Iraq, but also when you were in the Marine Corps and a DoD civilian? You have probably a better sense than your predecessors did about the art of the possible and what the focus should really be and how things work in Iraq. I mean, I remember when we first went into Iraq, no one knew any of that. So we were trying anything, and there was a lot of things that didn't work very well. But you've got now this great blessing of going into Iraq, helping NATO put together teams based on past experience. So how is that shaping what the alliance is going to do in Iraq?
It's a great question, you know, Jim, because as we put this mission together, almost exactly a year ago, we were really putting the building blocks together. We were very conscious of the need to apply the lessons of the last 35 or 40 years of doing this. And there's plenty of lessons to be drawn from Afghanistan, from Kosovo, from other places in the Balkans. And I think we've successfully put those together, and you see it on display in NATO's mission in Iraq. So I would disagree with you. It's not a continuation of NATO training mission Iraq from the early 2000s. This mission is very much focused on one thing, and this is making the transition from foreigners training Iraqis to Iraqis training Iraqis. Yeah. And, you know, we use this phrase, it drives me crazy sometimes, train the trainer.
Yeah, I know.
and we throw that around. But, you know, I'm very focused on this, and I know all the way down the military chain of command, they're very focused on getting this right and getting it right the first time. And you know, one of the lessons from operating in these places is that the host nation government needs to be a good partner if you're gonna make traction. And so we are, through our design of the mission, taking a unique approach. And our buzz phrase is, we will train instructors one time. So unlike in other places where we train instructors again and again and again, sometimes for years,
right,
sometimes for more than 10 years,
right,
but you find out that they are not in the institutions, they're not in the schools for which they were trained. In this mission, we are training instructors one time, and the commander is very fixed on ensuring that he's got the right group of trainers, the right group of Iraqi instructors before he even begins training them, and a commitment from the government that they will stay in the school. So he will soon be training Iraqi instructors in many of the skills that you'd expect, you know, an infantry school, an artillery school, a communication school, and several others. But he will train those instructors, a group of instructors, over the course of a few months. And then we will quickly turn the instruction over to the Iraqis. And the Iraqis will be running the school with us looking over their shoulder a little bit. And then we will step back even farther, and they will be running the schools by themselves. What is perhaps most unique in this mission, though, is if 6 months or a year later, the Iraqis come back and say, we need more instructors at this school, the commander is obligated to say, I've already trained your instructors. And if it's important to you, you will keep the instructors in the school. And if you don't keep them in the school, then it's not important to you, therefore it's not important to us. So one of the things we're looking at, or we've done here, is we wanna protect allied investment. Because if you don't have this type of an approach, then the mission can just run on indefinitely, and we can't afford to do that. You know, Iraq is really emblematic of this this whole concept of projecting stability. And if we're gonna do that as an alliance, we've gotta demonstrate to allies and to partners that we have a capability of going into a place like Iraq, delivering very specific and tailored effects, and then getting out and recocking so we're ready to go into another location and if required and do something similar.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great. And I look forward to maybe next year, if we can do this, is to see how this is beginning to work. Because I we've seen for years now all the various attempts, not just in Afghanistan and Iraq, but other places too, and not just NATO, as we've tried to do this and have not found a formula that really works. And I hope this will, you know, have traction and work, and look forward to talking to you about it.
NATO's 70th anniversary. As you know, we're coming up on the anniversary here in April, and I think these types of anniversaries often inspire a little bit of reflection. But I think this anniversary is taking place in a really interesting context. So increasingly we're seeing certainly the president questioning the extent of the United States' commitment to NATO. And it's taking place, I think, even in a broader debate in the United States about the importance of allies and partners and America's role in the world. And so one of the things we're thinking a lot about here at CNAS is how we do a better job at articulating the importance of allies and partners, and especially NATO, to average Americans. And so given your experience in NATO, what do you wish that Americans better understood about NATO?
Well, I wish Americans better understood the value of NATO. You know, sometimes we laugh in the headquarters. I'll read a report, or I'll listen to someone saying, you know, there hasn't been a war in Europe in 70 years, so we don't need NATO. You know, my response is, you know, we haven't had a war in Europe in 70 years because of NATO. So, you know, why would we take down this organization that, frankly, isn't broken? I mean, it has, like any large institution, difficulties, and right now we're deep into this debate on burden sharing, and there are a host of issues. But you know, for the United States, for in particular, but for all the allies, you know, we are the United States. I would say, you know, we have 28 allies and partners that represents a huge chunk of the world's wealth and population. Others don't have that. China doesn't have that. Russia doesn't have that. We have that. And we're all committed, as I said before, to defending our democratic values. You can't put a price tag on that. So I think in this whole debate of 2% and burden sharing, we have to recognize this somewhat intangible value of this alliance that is always there when the U.S. needs it and calls upon it.
We're about running out of time, and so this is my last question, but it's one of my favorite questions that I like to ask, and I think particularly for John Manza, this is going to be a great question. I think you know I'm going to ask you, so I hope you're beginning to I'm buying you some time so you can come up with your answer. But so John's career has been a very interesting one, and what's been interesting about that is in terms of military issues, the state of the military, he has seen it both as a Marine in uniform for many years. He's been deployed out there, but he's seen it also from the civilian side within the Pentagon, which is its own culture and its own animal. And he was a manager there. He was an action officer there as well. He ran the NATO office. And then not only was he deployed out in Kabul with NATO there, but also at NATO headquarters. So he has an international hat, too. He's part of the international staff. He's looking at the United States and the U.S. military from that perspective. So my question, John, is the young John Manza who wore the Marine uniform, or the middle-aged John Manza who was in the Pentagon running the NATO policy office.
Now the old John Manza.
And now the old John Manza who's creaking around NATO headquarters as the Assistant Secretary General. So what would the young John Manza have said 20-some-odd years ago that the old John Manza would look back on and say, well, I guess it wasn't really that way after all? Give us a little feeling for what your thoughts are as you look back at that career.
Well, certainly. I mean, when I was a young guy in the Marine Corps, I never imagined I'd be at NATO headquarters. I don't think I knew what NATO headquarters was.
I'm sure your bosses thought the same thing.
Always good to be taken down a notch by you, Jim. You know, I mean, I do think about those times all the time. When we talk the readiness initiative, when we talk capacity building, we talk all these different things. I always hearken back to my perspective of being a guy in a rifle company or on the ground, or working in a provincial reconstruction team on the ground, or the time I spent in Kabul. And it shapes for me how we develop strategic plans because, you know, so many times I see us writing things and I think in the back of my head, you know, the poor guy or gal at the very small end is never going to be able to execute this. Yeah. So, you know, when I think back to being in the Marine Corps, even back then, sometimes, you know, you'd look at orders, strategic plans, and you'd wonder, how could anybody have thought we'd be able to do this? You know, it informs me every single day. You know, and then there's the dark days, especially when I worked for you, Jim, at the Pentagon, where I thought my career was at its all-time low, and you know,
we all did,
working
yeah.
for some old bureaucrat. But I mean, those things inform very much too. I mean, it's great to be in my job, though I try to very much disassociate myself from U.S. decision making. It's great to know how decisions are made in the Pentagon or in a military staff. So all these things come together. And now, you know, at NATO, you know, it's so much more complex because you are truly talking about 29 allies sitting around the table. And, you know, for folks who don't know NATO, we do everything by consensus. And I mean, every single thing has to be agreed by every single ally. So the documents, the plans we produce, every word, every comma is agreed by every single ally. So, you know, it's good to be able to draw upon, you know, many different perspectives and decades of experience when you put that together. And, you know, obviously in my role, I'm able to shape some of the allied views when they're making proposals on the at the table. But it's a fantastic environment. And despite the fact that you're working consensus at 29, we get things done.
Yeah.
And when you do make a decision, those decisions are very powerful because 29 democracies have agreed to them.
Yeah.
Before we thank John, I wanted to raise for our podcast listeners that we have a new feature in Brussels Sprouts. We've created an email address associated with the podcast. It's brusselssprouts@cnas.org, and we're hoping that listeners will reach out, ask questions, anything that you want to follow up in what you've heard in the podcasts, and send along any ideas for episodes or people you'd like to hear from. So looking to reach out to listeners a bit more, so please let us know your thoughts.
And if you have any criticisms about Brussels Sprouts, particularly this segment, send them to John Manza, who will add this to his portfolio.
But John, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. It was really an enjoyable conversation, and we're fortunate to have you.
Thanks, John, so much, and good luck.
It was really my pleasure, and thank you, both you guys, for inviting me over.